Hello and welcome to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, the history of the Silk Road, as told by three different writers. The Silk Road has a human history that stretches back millennia. This part of the world was central to Islam's golden age and the great flowering of science, mathematics, medicine and the arts. Since then, the city of Bukhara in modern-day Uzbekistan has been a major centre of learning, culture and spirituality. For much of the 20th century, Central Asia was part of the Soviet Union. Then in 1991, after the breakup of the USSR, the former Central Asian Soviet Republics, or the STANs, opened up to the world for the first time. The region that's now made up of Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan and Tajikistan was once known to the West as Turkestan. In the 19th and 20th centuries, only a handful of Westerners made the long journey there. Today we hear from three very different travellers who visited Turkestan across 100 years, but all three had their sights on the glorious city of Bukhara. Our producer, Kara Rosehope, follows in their footsteps.
Our journey north from Kabul had been of a most trying nature, but Bukhara, once so distant, had grown ever closer. Our mode of travelling had been extremely irksome, for camels only advance at half the pace of a horse, and as well, we had been almost burned up with the heat. Finally, on the 27th of June, 1832, an hour after sunrise, we found ourselves at the gates of Bukhara.
Alexander Burns was a Scottish-born officer in the East India Army and explorer, spy and adventurer. In 1832, he was sent to the almost unknown emirate of Bukhara with its ancient Silk Road capital. Dressed in local clothes, fluent in Persian, the lingua franca of the region, Alexander Burns was able to move freely about the city. He was 27 years old.
The city of Bukhara lies embosomed among gardens and trees. It is an oasis bounded by desert and is a delightful place. The city is surrounded by a wall of earth 20 feet high with a circumference which exceeds 8 miles. When the traveller passes through its gates, he winds his way among lofty and arched bazaars of brick. Everywhere he meets with ponderous and massy buildings, colleges, mosques and soaring minarets. Upon our entering the city, the authorities did not even search us. But in the afternoon, an officer summoned us to the presence of the Kushbegi or Wazir. I proceeded alone to the palace of the Emir, where the Kushbegi also lives. This dignitary interrogated me for 2 hours as to my own affairs and the objectives that brought me to a country as remote as Bukhara. I told my usual tale of travelling towards our native country and produced my passport from the Governor General of India. I then added that Bukhara was a place of such celebrity that we had been chiefly induced to visit Turkestan for the purpose of seeing it. The Kushbegi here made various observations on the customs and politics of Europe, particularly of Russia, on which he was well informed. On the whole, he appeared to be satisfied of our character and assured me of his protection. However, while in Bukhara, he said he must prohibit our using pen and ink, since it may lead to our conduct being misrepresented to the king and prove injurious to our well-being.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
The greatest of the public buildings in Bukhara is a mosque which has a dome covered in tiles of azure. Attached to this mosque is a lofty minaret of bricks arranged in a most ingenious pattern. From which criminals are thrown to their death.
But the Buhara that Alexander Burnes found was a far cry from the city which had played such a part in Islam's golden age. That Buhara had been all but destroyed in the 13th century by Genghis Khan.
Until Genghis Khan, Central Asia was easily the most productive region in the greater Middle East. It had a thriving city culture. It was the granary of the region. And Genghis Khan came and destroyed a lot of canals and irrigation systems, and the cities lay in ruins. And that was really a mortal blow to the splendid Central Asian civilization of the classical period. And after Genghis Khan, there were any number of local dynasties who never quite reached the high point of cultural development. The Khanates completely lost contact with the rest of the world. World trade moved from overland silk routes to maritime trade, and these Khanates became well and truly forgotten by the rest of the world. I am Dr. Kirill Nurjanov. I am a senior lecturer at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University in Canberra.
My usual resort in the evening was the Registan of Buhara, a spacious area near the palace, which opens upon it. On one side of this space is a fountain shaded by lofty trees, where idlers and newsmongers assemble around the wares exposed for sale. From morn to night, the crowd here raises a humming noise, and one is stunned at the moving mass of human beings. Almost everything may be purchased in the Registan: the fruits of the season, the jewellery and cutlery of Europe, the tea of China, the sugar of India, the spices of Manila. A stranger has only to seat himself on a bench at the Registan to know the people of Buhara. He may hear converse with the natives of Persia, Turkey, Russia, Tartary, China, India, and Kabul. There are as well Hindus, Jews, and the stray Armenian. The Uzbeks manage all their affairs by means of slaves, who are chiefly brought from Persia by the Turkmens. But now and then a native of China or of Russia who has lost his liberty will arrest the attention. With these exceptions, the stranger beholds in the bazaars a portly, fair and well-dressed mass of people, the Mohammedans of Turkestan.
We don't really know who were the aboriginal inhabitants of Central Asia. What we know for sure is that sometime in the second millennium BC, there was an infusion of the Aryans. Nobody knows where they came from. Some people say from the northern shores of the Black Sea, others say from the Caucasus, but the fact is that towards the beginning of the first millennium BC, the population in what is now Central Asia were Aryans. The next big milestone in the gestation of modern Central Asia would be probably the 5th century AD, when a new ethnic element was introduced to Central Asia, and these were the Turks. They came from Siberia and they settled, they mingled with the Iranian speakers in Central Asia, and the result was quite complex ethnic landscape.
A great many of the people in Buhara appear on horseback, including the ladies. A few walk, and all of the ladies are veiled with a black haircloth. The difficulty of seeing through it makes the fair ones stare at everyone. Here, however, no one must speak to them, and if any of the king's harem passes, you are admonished to look in another direction and get a blow on the head if you neglect the advice.
Buhara-e Sharif, Buhara the Sacred, was the buzzword long before Genghis Khan, and the city continued to have this reputation of the center of Islamic learning. There were quite a few maktabs and madrasas, secondary and tertiary institutions of Islamic learning. They had lost any influence in the Muslim world. So thus, both for the British and the Russian explorers, Buhara was the absolute emblem, the epitome of the worst kind of ossified, backward, misogynistic Islam.
During our stay in Buhara, numerous persons came to visit us at our lodgings to gratify their curiosity at our expense. As we were not permitted to write, it was an agreeable manner of passing time, since they were very communicative. The Uzbeks are simple people. Many betrayed suspicions of our character, but still showed no unwillingness to converse on all points, from the politics of their emir to the state of their markets. A month nearly has elapsed since our arrival in Buhara, and it is necessary to think of moving on with our journey. I cannot say that I felt much regret at the prospect of leaving, since we would be more free from suspicion and thus able to write. We had indeed managed to use the pen at night with leaden eyes, but even then we did so with fear. On the morning of the 21st of July, our caravan was ready. The camels preceded us as we exited the Buhara city gates.
Alexander Burns returned to England in 1834 and published a book about his journey. His knowledge of the region was useful to his government in the Great Game, the contest for Central Asia between the British and the Russian empires. But by the time Englishwoman Annette Macon visited the region at the start of the 20th century, Turkestan was firmly in Russian hands. Annette Macon was an independent writer and traveller, with a leaning towards anthropology. By the time she was 35, she'd travelled through much of the Muslim world. And, in 1902, she took herself to Turkestan. Her command of the Russian language gave her an entree to the Russians who'd settled in the region. It also enabled her to use local interpreters to communicate with the Uzbeks. And, as a female traveller, Annette Macon had access to the women, who observed strict segregation.
From the outset, I would like to acknowledge that this visit to Russian Turkestan has been made possible by the kindness of His Imperial Majesty, the Tsar of Russia. Thanks are due also to Colonel Horvath, Chief of the Central Asian Railways, who made a luxuriously fitted carriage available for our use throughout the stay. As early as the 12th and 13th centuries, Russia was connected by commerce with the peoples of Central Asia. Hiva and Bukhara sent their caravans across her steppes to Russia, yet it was not until 1867 that Russian troops made their way to the region and began to take possession. Today, at the dawn of this new century, in 1902, the eastern dominions of His Majesty the Tsar stretch from the shores of the Caspian to the Chinese border.
The precise moment when St. Petersburg and the Tsars announced to the rest of the world that Central Asia lies within the scope of its imperialist ambition was 1864. Russia was going through the first phase of industrialization then. The textile industry in particular was the locomotive of economic progress in the empire, and it just so happened that cotton was an essential element, an essential raw material for the Russian textile industry. And Russia used to import a lot of cotton from the United States, and of course the Civil War in the United States cut those supplies, and the Russians were quite desperate to acquire a new and reliable source of cotton. And lo and behold, what is now Uzbekistan, rich lands irrigated by the two mighty rivers, the Amudarya and the Sirdarya, provided quite a bit of cotton that the Russians needed quite badly just at that period of time. In addition to this, we should not really discount the civilizing mission that weighed heavily on the minds of the Tsar and his generals, because Russia was just like the rest of Europe. Everyone from London to Paris to St. Petersburg sincerely believed that they had a Christian mission to bring Enlightenment to bring modernity, to bring a modicum of rationalism to the barbarians down south. It is noteworthy that slavery continued to exist in the Khanate of Khiva until very late into the 19th century.
Turkestan is peopled in part by a sedentary race called the Sarts and in part by nomads. The Sarts are a mixture of the earliest inhabitants of Turkestan, the Indo-Germanic or Persian race, with every other race that during the last 2,000 years has invaded the land. Of course, increasingly of late, there are Russians who live in distinct towns of their own. Bukhara, of ancient fame, may be classed as a Sart town. The streets of a Sart town are little more than twisting pathways between windowless mud walls of courtyards which enclose each house. I have roamed about old Bukhara without encountering one solitary female figure. However, in the towns that are completely under Russian sway, one certainly sees more women about. But even then, their presence does little to enliven the scene. Rich and poor alike, the women are enveloped in a shapeless outer garment of sombre grey, the paranja, with veils of black horsehair.
My name is Marianne Camp. I'm an associate professor of history at the University of Wyoming, and my area of research expertise, the area that I write about, is Central Asia in the 20th century. I'm a historian. In some of the major cities in Central Asia, our evidence suggests that women were really heavily veiled when they went outside of their homes. Travelers to Bukhara, in particular, noted that when women went out on the street, they were usually wearing a heavy veiling robe that was called a paranja and a heavy veiling face cover that covered all the way down to their chest.
No man who is not a family member may visit the ladies in their own quarters where they go unveiled. However, as a woman, I could do so, usually taking with me a Tatar female interpreter. It would be hard to beat the Sarts in their generous and open-hearted hospitality. Invariably, we were greeted with the time-honoured tray of fruits, sweets and nuts. The reception room of a Sart lady is, at the same time, her living room, her bedroom, and where her clothing is stored. Gorgeous silken robes and flashing jewellery were displayed before our admiring eyes, and the ladies were none loath to don their finery that I might photograph them. On almost every occasion when I succeeded in obtaining permission to photograph the women, their husbands only allowed it, with the understanding that the pictures would appear only in my book. Happily for me, it never seemed to enter their heads that a copy might someday reach Central Asia. Until she is 9 years old, a girl is allowed almost as much freedom as her brothers, and she's even allowed to play with them in the street. After that, she is strictly confined to the women's quarters, and her father may begin to look around for a suitable husband.
Traditionally in Central Asia, Islamic forms of formal education were widespread. There would be a literate imam or an imam's helper who would give lessons, usually to boys. There were also educated women in cities mainly, but also in small towns. And in Central Asia, their title was Atun or Atun. And Atun was a woman who was at least capable of reading, certainly capable of teaching someone else how to recite prayers correctly. She might know part of the Quran. She might know all of the Quran. She would have some access to reading, some access to writing. Some Ottons were fully literate and composed poetry and taught girls not just religious knowledge, but also the literary treasures of Central Asia. However, most evidence would suggest that boys had a lot more access to reading, writing, and basic education in Central Asia than girls did.
On the matter of girls, many Russians living in Turkestan had assured me that such a thing as a girls' school did not exist in here. Thus, I was surprised to find, upon inquiry of Sart ladies of the higher class, that each had been to school. We visited an interesting such school in Kokand. The schoolmistress, head covered in white muslin, sat among her 45 pupils, both girls and boys, while they read about the Prophet Muhammad. This charming old lady made way for us on the floor and talked intelligently about her work. The chief occupation of the sedentary population in Turkestan is agriculture, and it is on the produce of their fields and gardens that they mainly subsist. Turkestan has grown Indian cotton since time immemorial, but next to the arrival of the Russians themselves, no event has brought so many changes into the life of the Sarts as the introduction of high-yielding American cotton. Certain Moscow capitalists, being fully aware that labour was far cheaper in Central Asia, turned their attention to the matter, and from that day on, cotton has been quickly and steadily taking the place of every other field produce in the country. The Sarts are also discovering that the way to become rich is to cultivate cotton. The cotton grower is paid three times over the rice grower. Consequently, every Sart who has an inch of ground that he can call his own is beginning to plant cotton. The emir of Bukhara forces his subjects to grow a certain amount of corn on their private lands, and thus the danger of famine, in that province at least, is warded off.
Until the Russian colonial conquest, Turkestan was self-sufficient in grain. A bit of cotton was grown, of course, but the bulk of arable land was dedicated to cereal production. When the Russians came, they said, no, it's nonsense, we need as much cotton as we could possibly get from Turkestan, and we'll just import grain from the rest of the empire. So thus, it came to pass that at the turn of the 20th century, Central Asia, while Turkestan lost its self-sufficiency, it became dependent on imports of grain from the rest of the empire.
That investment in a cotton economy really moved Central Asia toward an entirely new direction, toward exporting and toward new forms of labor, toward an interest in getting railroads. There were Central Asians who became investors, who became merchants, and who became wealthy out of this new association with Russia.
Malarial fevers are the cause of half the deaths in Turkestan. I did not travel to a single town where fever of one kind or the other was not prevalent. Sometimes they come upon the people like an epidemic and carry off thousands at a time. Leprosy is to be met with everywhere, for though the lepers are banished to separate villages, they come into the towns and beg. Smallpox, too, must be common in Turkestan, as a large proportion are pockmarked. In every native town of any size, Bukhara included, there is now a Russian apothecary, a doctor, and a lady doctor, with hospitals for native men and women respectively. The Russian lady doctors lead a busy life, for Sart women are beginning to have confidence in them and give them more work already than they can possibly get through. Maternity patients only come to the hospital when an operation is necessary.
In 1903, Annette Meakin returned to England. She published her account of Turkestan, which was then an eastern outpost of the Russian Empire. But By the time a young African-American jazz poet arrived in Turkestan in 1932, the Russian Empire no longer existed. In the wake of the Russian Revolution in 1917, Turkestan had been remade as Soviet Central Asia.
In the summer of 1932, I had received an unexpected invitation to work on a film about race relations in America. It was for a Russian-German company. So I became part of a group of 22 Negroes who had traveled to Moscow to make the film. I was to write the English dialogue.
Langston Hughes was a poet, novelist, playwright, and social activist. By the age of 30, when he visited Turkestan, he was the unofficial poet laureate of the African American community.
We've been offered a tour of any section of the Soviet Union we might be interested in. It had not taken us long to agree that the portion of the Soviet Union we would like to see were those regions where the majority of the colored citizens live, namely Turkestan in Central Asia. At that time, this part of the Soviet Union was forbidden territory to foreigners. But eventually, about a dozen of us entrained for a long 5-day trip to Tashkent. I had obtained a press permit to remain in Central Asia long enough to write about it. I brought along a typewriter, my Victrola record player, a big box of Louis Armstrong, Bessie Smith, Duke Ellington, and Ethel Waters. We emerged from the Kizilkum Desert one afternoon to speed through the fertile oases of water and greenery. Cotton growing, trees and fruit, then crowds of green-brown Uzbeks in flowered robes waving from village stations. In the evening, we came to Tashkent. As we pulled into the depot, there stood a crowd of Asiatic writers, artists, and theater people come to meet us at the station. Exotically clothed Uzbeks, Turkmens, and Tartars. They crowded us with their national gowns and veils, with gifts of fruit and flowers. In the night air, there was the smell of the Orient, a kind of mixture of musk and melons and dust that seemed everywhere a part of the East, and here and there, the muted sound of the lute. At Tashkent, then in Samarkand and Bukhara, we met officials and committees, visited institutes and factories, and saw historic monuments. And everywhere we went, delegations greeted us with speeches and statistics in Russian, Tartar, and Turkoman, and full of Soviet socialist zeal. The native officials everywhere tried too hard to convince us of the progress made under the new regime. A great deal had happened, but thousands of women were still in harems and veiled head to foot in public. Muezzins still called to prayer from tall towers. Bazaars were still filthy. The streets were dusty. And it was very hot.
Langston Hughes was not traveling in Central Asia the way you or I might travel in Central Asia in 2013. He couldn't hide. He couldn't blend in. He was pretty clearly different from everybody who surrounded him. And he was a celebrated poet who had been translated into Russian, who was eventually translated into Uzbek. And he was, as the Soviets would have put it, a member of an oppressed class of Americans, somebody who had been oppressed in the capitalist world. So he really fit a lot of Soviet narratives. Langston Hughes was very closely attended to by what you can certainly call his handlers. These were people in the OGPU, which was the predecessor of the KGB, who looked after his lodging, and though it's unclear exactly how much control they had over him, would have had a significant impact over which sorts of people he encountered and who he met and under which circumstances. My name is David Keone Moore, and I'm Associate Professor of English, International Studies, and African Studies at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, in the U.S.
In early November 1932, I arrived back in Bukhara. During the days, I mostly wandered around by myself. I mused upon the turbulent history of ancient Bukhara, high, holy, divinely descended Bukhara, or as the communists term it, Bukhara, the Mullah Ridden. I was intrigued by the harem wives in long horsehair veils, making their way through the busy streets like walking bundles. But sometimes, I sat watching the streets from a tea house where a modern Bukhara woman, who had escaped from a harem and burned her veil, had got herself a job as a cashier. She was now taking in cash and coupons for tea and cakes as the camels of old Asia and the new Soviet autobuses pass outside.
On the issue of the emancipation of the women, the crucial year here is 1928, when the Central Committee unleashed the so-called Hujum campaign. Hujum is an Uzbek and Persian word meaning a storm or a frontal attack, an assault. As part of this campaign, Hujum campaign, women were encouraged to unveil themselves, sometimes quite openly. There was a lot of pressure on women and girls in Turkestan to leave the confines of their houses and to become employed in the public sector, in those new giant factories that were mushrooming under the plan of industrialization.
The Soviets had put in place all sorts of laws that ought to have made men and women equal, but really had had no effect. And communist ideologists and activists in 1927 said, well, perhaps the problem is people just don't know about these laws. What we need is a big education campaign. We need to get out there and tell people what the laws are so that women will understand that they have a right to go to school, or that they have a right to reject a marriage that they don't want, or that they have a right to divorce, or they have a right to support, or various other things like that. What really changed things was probably not that campaign. What really began to change things was education. This would be my interpretation in any case. In the late 1920s, the state began to have enough teachers trained at a very basic level, perhaps capable of teaching 2-3 years of basic literacy, but they had enough teachers that they could really begin to establish schools in small villages. Along with another huge economic change, collectivization, which created collective farms out in the countryside.
In the autumn, if you step off a train almost anywhere in the fertile parts of Central Asia, you step upon a cotton field or onto a city whose streets are filled with evidence of cotton nearby. The natives call it white gold. In Soviet Central Asia, I visited several cotton kolkhozes, collective farms. I heard about the yields and irrigations. I saw the cotton college, visited the cotton trust. I studied the charts. I looked at statistics. I've forgotten the figures, but I shall always remember what the natives themselves told me. Before, there were no schools for Uzbek children. Now there are. Before, we lived in debt and fear. Now we are free. Before, women were bought and sold. Not no more. Before, the land and the water belong to the overlords. Today, the land and the water are ours, and we share the cotton. On my return to Tashkent in late November, I became sick, very sick. So that I was not alone, it was arranged that I had shared an apartment with a young man who was the physical cultural director for Tashkent, whose skin was as brown as my own. His name was Yusuf Nikan, now Nikanov. By the end of November 1932, it was very cold in Tashkent. There was snow on the ground. Russians sleigh with horses and bells sped through the streets, alongside humping camels whose breath rose like clouds of steam to float above the burdens on their back. Coal was not to be had, and wood, in a largely desert country, was very expensive. The state publishers had given me a check for 6,000 rubles as an advance on my book, The Weary Blues. And with this money, it was possible for me to buy a whole camel load of wood. It was a book of poems about Negro life in America and was being published, translated in Uzbek. The Uzbeks were interested in this book because under the Tsar, they remembered they had been treated like Negroes were treated in Mississippi. Before the Soviet Revolution, there had even been a Jim Crow section of Asiatics on streetcars and trains. Nick Hahn had many great friends who would visit, and with The Roaring Fire, My Harlem Victrola playing Bessie Smith, Louis Armstrong, and Ethel Waters, Nick Hahn and I had more company than ever. 10 years ago, Nick Hahn had been a homeless orphan, dirty, ignorant, scab-covered. The Soviet government had corralled him into one of their schools and found him eager and alert, with qualities of leadership. Now, Nick Hahn was in charge of the athletic activities of 1,000 boys and girls who, like himself, until recently, had never had a chance. Nowadays, the schools in Central Asia were filled to overflowing, and thousands of sturdy Asiatic young men and women in their early 20s were in positions of trust as representatives of the people. And begging, that scourge of the Orient, had almost disappeared. With work for all and building of homes for the aged and the infirm, and the creation of communes for homeless children, the old familiar cry of the East, alms, alms, for the love of Allah, was seldom heard, except from a few holy beggars.
It's important to recognize that every time Langston Hughes says something about a Central Asian, he's simultaneously saying something about its theoretical opposite in the United States. So, just for example, at one point, he notes in one of his writings that a gentleman he's speaking with, whose skin is darker than his own, happens to be the mayor of the city Soviet of Bukhara. And I have no doubt that Langston Hughes is telling the truth, but it's also important that when we hear or we read a sentence like that, it's an implicit critique of the fact that no person in the United States at that time whose skin was darker than Langston Hughes's, or whose skin was even the same color as Langston Hughes's, would have been able to be anything equivalent to the mayor of the city Soviet of Bukhara.
In 1933, Langston Hughes returned to the United States and published articles about Central Asia in both Russian and American magazines. And he later wrote of it in a memoir. A good deal of the promise Langston Hughes saw in the Soviet Republic was fulfilled. Then, in 1991...
Moscow formally ringing in the Soviet changes with the new year. Good morning, John Logan with ABC National News. The Soviet Union will cease to exist as a country on New Year's Eve.
For a new world of hope.
George Bush at the start of the post-Gorbachev era, setting the scene for Washington's
Moldova,
new relations
Turkmenistan,
with
Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, Tajikistan, Georgia, and Uzbekistan.
It's really hard to fathom the depth of and the sheer magnitude of the problems that affected both the regime in Uzbekistan and the ordinary people. Just one example, the economy of the country was devastated because Uzbekistan came to rely on subventions from Moscow, came to rely on subsidized trade in petroleum products from the rest of the Soviet Union, and of course it relied heavily on the exports of its main commodity, that is cotton, to the markets in the Soviet Union. All of this disappeared virtually overnight, and the Uzbek government had to improvise how to survive economically. Politically, Uzbekistan was ill-prepared for the travails of independence. Again, all decisions used to be made in Moscow, especially decisions concerning foreign relations and defense and state security. There were no institutions in Uzbekistan geared to safeguard the territorial integrity and national sovereignty of the new republic. Thus, the president of the country, Islam Karimov, had to improvise and had to learn on the job.
Dr. Kirill Nurzhanov. Professor Marianne Kamp has studied Uzbek women and the changes in their lives across the 20th century.
1990s were rough in Uzbekistan. They were difficult economically, and that economic turmoil created quite a lot of change, and it created a lot of differentiation so that there are impoverished rural areas where families really do not have very good access to education beyond the most basic elementary levels. And there are phenomenally wealthy people in some cities who can do anything they want to and send their children wherever they want to in the world. Women in the mid-2000s, at least, occupied about 40% of all of the seats in higher education in Uzbekistan. For many Uzbek families, probably the majority of Uzbek families, sending one's daughter all the way through high school and to some aspect of higher education is a pretty normal thing to do. And so there continues to be this pipeline of well-educated women who enter business and politics and so forth and continue to play these really prominent roles in society.
Nowadays, the schools in Central Asia were filled to overflowing, and thousands of sturdy
Asiatic young men. No man who is not a family member may visit the ladies in their own quarters where they go unveiled.
The city of Buhara lies embosomed among gardens and trees. It is an oasis bounded by desert and is a delightful place.
Kara Rosehope presented and produced Journeys to Bukhara. The sound engineer was Tim Simons.